All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. You are not a very enthusiastic clapper, Lindsay.
That felt wildly anticlimactic to me. Well, like when you listen, you're like, oh, Mormon Expression, but here it's just...
What?
I don't know.
Here it's what? You didn't finish your sentence.
I expected like sparkles or confetti or something.
Oh, Lindsay. So at my left is Lindsay Park, the world-famous feminist, who's right about many, many things.
Yes, I'm always right about things.
Welcome back, Lindsay. Lindsay, you've become a regular, and I think you're the most popular person on the podcast. So
I believe someone called me the most annoying commenter on the podcast.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Well, okay. And see what I can do tonight.
Joining us again is Jenny. Jenny, how many times is this?
This is two.
This is a second.
Number two.
Welcome back, Jenny. Jenny is one of our all-star therapists who conducts some of the workshops we have here, right?
Yes. Come. Register for one.
So you're
doing, really are good.
You're doing the women's group. And you are doing something that I've been excited about, and it's something that I'm really pleased to see come to fruition. We're having a group for
mixed faith couples.
What is a mixed faith couple? Is that like we're one?
So one is in or more in or more of a theist or something of the sort, and one is more out, not in. More of a non-theist, anything like that. Anything where there's conflict in the relationship in regards to how to manage differences of beliefs, things like that.
Over the years, I've had a lot of people reach out to me, and this has been one of the most heartbreaking things that I've seen and dealt with and observed, that the pressure of leaving the church on a marriage is enormous, and especially in the LDS paradigm, because so much of your marriage identity is wrapped up in that. And the transition to a healthy marriage is not trivial, and it's difficult for everybody, and this is what we're trying to work out. And the kicker is, of course, you're not doing the workshop alone.
Nope. So I'll be joined by James Ott, who's a therapist here in Salt Lake, and he is an active Mormon therapist.
He's an active believing Mormon. We verified that. And there's a lot of fakers out there. And I'm not saying there's a lot of faker therapists, but there are a lot of fakers out there.
And some faker therapists.
So we have both of you who'll be conducting that, and I think it'll be a great session. Now, Lindsay does many, many things out there, and one of the things that she does for Whitefields, you are the director of counseling services. And so we have these going on. What else is up your sleeve, Lindsay?
Well, that's the main focus for Whitefields right now, is getting our counseling sessions underway. So we've launched the two right now, just a basic faith identity disruption group and the women's group. And then this one's coming out there. And we have other projects that are in the works, but nothing to discuss yet.
Yeah, which one did I put out there to see if people wanted to do it? I've forgotten already.
I don't know. Are you giving me more work to do, Jeff?
Yeah, it was about, I can't remember. It's something to do with marriage. Oh, yes, it was our two-parter. We're looking for interest in this. The first one is, should I stay or should I go? It's a 6-week group session on deciding if your marriage is right for you. And it will be followed on by a workshop, which is going through an amicable divorce, which is how to establish proper boundaries, how to co-parent, how to communicate with your ex, how to deal with issues with children, and that sort of thing. So we're hoping to have that session up probably in the early fall. And so we're looking for interested participants. You don't have to go, like, if you already know you're going to leave, you can just skip to the to 201. You don't have to do the freshman year there if you don't want.
So we have that, and we have community events probably planned. Oh, the one thing that I did want to say, though, is we're going to dedicate a specific budget for counseling services. So we're going to ask for donations specifically for counseling services.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who've said counseling is great, but I don't need it. And that's a viable answer. But we do have a lot of people who approach us who might be not have the means to be able to pay for it. And Jenny, please confirm, you're out there in the business, that what we're charging is well below the nominal normal rate for therapists.
For the therapy groups?
Yes.
Yes.
So here's your opportunity. If you're well beyond therapy, we're looking to help establish a sort of a fund or an endowment, if you will, for people who can't afford it themselves. So if you go to our whitefieldseducational.org website, go to the counseling services, right up top there's a donation button, and that money gets directed directly towards helping pay for the counseling services and for folks who may or may not be able to afford it.
Yeah, and I think it's really important because, you know, John and I are not making money off of this, but we want this thing to be self-sustainable and to last. And there's been a huge amount of interest in it, so we'd like to see it continue. So if you could go support it, maybe adopt a post-Mormon, that would be awesome. So
yeah, and if you go to the site, we also have a directory of therapists who we have vetted and screened who are seasoned at dealing with religious transition issues. They're not all in the state of Utah, but there's several of them, including Jenny, you do now, who will do sessions by Skype. So if you're not in the Salt Lake City area and would still like to talk to somebody, we have therapists in Washington and all over the place, and we're getting more and more.
Just added one from New York.
So we're getting more therapists all the time. So that's a great resource. Once again, we don't just put anybody there. We make sure that they meet our standards of because we are like the AMA. They meet our standards of not being too douchey. I don't know what our standards are. Okay, so check out the counseling services. Excellent. Lindsay's doing a wonderful job, and you know, who would ever thought we could have pulled it off? But thank you, Lindsay. You've sort of built that from the ground up.
You're welcome.
All right, well, let's get into the news for the week. It's the 22nd of April, 2014. A couple of small stories. First of all, the American atheists were in town over Easter, because nothing says Easter like atheists in Salt Lake City. I didn't. Did any of you go? Anybody go to the? Was it any good?
It depends on what you're looking for.
Yeah.
We went to a panel discussion.
Oh, you went to a panel discussion.
The night before the convention.
What were they discussing?
It was two BYU professors and two atheists, and they were hoping to bridge the gap with the mythology that goes around, but it didn't really end up being so much that.
Well, you know, this is what I tell people all the time. It's debating religious people is kind of hard because they come at it from an entirely different paradigm, and debate doesn't even work. You know, it's just it's something that's you're not talking to the other folks, but they, you know, they get into questioning belief and epistemology and how do we know what's real anyway, and so it's not as entertaining as it would sound. That being said, I will challenge any believer to a debate on at any. That might be fun. All right, it's American Atheists in Salt Lake City. This week, local prominent rock and roll frontman Tyler Glenn for the Neon Trees came out as a happy Mormon gay man. He said he's still happy to have his LDS identity, and he's switch hitting, I guess.
Yeah, well, he came out a few weeks ago, but now he's saying that he's gay and Mormon.
Yes, so. Yeah, you're right. He came out as gay 3 weeks ago, and he came out as Mormon this week. So that's why I hit our news. You know, more power to him. You know, there's other.
I know a lot of gay Mormons, so he's in luck. Maybe a temple marriage is in his future.
There seem to be a lot of gay Mormon frontmen for bands, too.
Mm-hmm. That's what I hear.
Yeah. Speaking of gay frontmen, Cliven Bundy down in Nevada is, of course, in a standoff with the BLM about grazing cattle. But they're dropping a lot of Mormon rhetoric down there that if you're an insider, you'll recognize that. I think I even saw a picture where they had a title of Liberty, like all these nuts with guns down there. And really, it's like 400 head of cattle that graze out 800,000 acres of wilderness. It's time to stop.
He's like a chubbier Abinadi, you know?
Is Abinadi thin? Yeah, I guess the
Have you seen the picture?
Yeah, he looks like a marathoner or something.
Yeah,
you're talking about the Arnold Freeberg.
Cliven, not so much, but he is standing up to the government.
The fascinating thing is, in standing up to the government, he's in a showdown with our friendly Mormon senator, Reed. What's his first name?
Harry.
How could I forget that? Harry Reid. So it's and if you ask Mike Tannehill, all the Vegas Mormons hate Harry Reid, but he's their spokesman down there. You ever know if you go to Deseret Book, there's a whole section of political writing, and they don't usually have any Harry Reid there, you know. But he's really one of the most powerful Mormons that have ever been. I mean, he's like second in line to the Constitution hanging by his thread or whatever. But he's right there, but Mormons try to pretend he doesn't exist.
He's the only thing that sews the Constitution together right now.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Go Harry Reid.
There was a petition a few years back to get him excommunicated, but it didn't go anywhere. Okay, the story that I've been waiting for, the church is suing the dating website Mormon Match for two things. They had a picture of the temple, and they used the word Mormon in their title. Hey, you fuckers down on Temple Square, I've been doing that for 5 years. Where's the summons? Who are you going to push around, you know? Mormon stories, Mormon expression, Mormon what?
That's a good point.
Why are they suing these? Why do they choose to bully these?
Hey, I like to see a small American religion stand up to corporate America. Stick it to them, church. That's right. You show these people. They can't persecute us. Have you heard of religious freedom? It's under attack right now.
Yeah. Look, it's... Okay, so you have an excellent point.
Thank you.
Which is, Mormons keep insisting they're a culture. That they're a legitimate culture. And they're a faith. On par with...
Wait a minute. We're not Mormons. We're Latter-day Saints, but go on.
Well, we've copyrighted Mormon.
Exactly. But, that's our point.
But you can't... If you want to be considered legitimate, as a legitimate culture, you can't go around policing the usage of your term by a bunch of corporate suits at Curtin and McConkie. That doesn't... Those two things don't match. If you want to be... Can you imagine if the Catholic Church were to sue some person for using an image of a cathedral... Like it's patently ridiculous. You would think they'd all gone insane. And that's the way this looks to the rest of the world. You remember a few weeks ago when I chided the ex-Mormons about the lawsuit in Britain, and I said, no one gives a fuck. It's the same thing on this front. And if you're suing people for using pictures of your cathedral, because in Salt Lake, because Mormons, that's what it is to everybody else. It's a big... Gothic, ugly church. And if you sue people for a picture of that, you've crossed the line. You're not cultural.
Have you seen McConkie's office outside City Creek?
Curtin and McConkie's?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's a big thing.
Right up above the Cheesecake
Factory.
How
are they going to pay for that? Like, what are they going to do? Settle out of court sexual lawsuits all day? No. They have to make money somehow.
Well, it's really interesting they're going to sue this Mormon dating website. Wasatch has used the Devastator beer... with the logo of the temple on beer for, what, 8-9 years now? It's interesting they haven't went after them.
He's holding it right now, by the way.
close.
Well,
close.
This is my point. Curtin McConkie, I don't know if it's Curtin McConkie in this case, they really don't want this to go to court. They're just trying to muscle them out of business. And really, the reason that I... Honest to goodness, now, I'm not a lawyer, but that doesn't stop me. You could go to court and say, look, Mormon Expression has been using this term for 5 years. If you really wanted to police your term, you have to police it. And the fact that you haven't sued the rest of these people means that you're not doing that and you can't go after. They would win. Everybody knows that they would win. But the church can just pour money at these guys. And the reason they're doing it is because they're not lawyered up and they're not ready to fight. But it's silly. It's silly. All the things you guys could be doing, you're suing a dating website. My God. Stop it. Stop it.
Thank you,
I want a better fight. And lately the church has been doing so many dumb things that it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
You go, girlfriend.
Thank you. Wait, I read on the internet, so I'm trying to learn slang because I've realized that...
Oh, here we go. Gird your loins, people.
I've crossed the 40 line and I'm not up with slang. So I was reading one of those you know how like all the news articles today have like the word weird in them, you know, like 14 weird ways to impress your friend. That's like the news. Anyway, I'm supposed to say, okay, wait for it. Am I right, ladies?
Oh gosh.
That's like slang now, right? Am I right, ladies?
The only thing that's missing is a little like fake gun hand gesture.
Thanks for not laughing.
We're just off tonight. Something is off.
We are not off. We are on. You are off. This plays out well on the air. All right, so let's go into our topic for tonight. This is actually one that I will admit, I'm free to admit, that we did a little fun drive about 2 years ago and said, we'll do these five topics if we can get some, you know, some funding. We got the funding, and I think this is the last one, 2 years later, coming in. The Kubler-Ross model was once something I promised back in 2012. So here we are. And
yay.
This is one of the reasons that we brought in Jenny. Did they make you study this in school, right?
Well, actually, I had to Google it, and I was like, oh, yeah, it's the stages of grieving.
Yes.
So I didn't ever know it was called the Kubler-Ross, but
Kubler-Ross is the hyphenated name of the originator of this theory, which is the five stages of grief. You probably run into it. It shows up in cartoons and other things like that all the time. The five stages of grief being denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And we'll go through them in more detail. Ross, when she wrote her first book, which I read 2 years ago in preparation to this and have subsequently forgot everything she said in it, her research was on terminally ill patients. So she originally was observing the stages that people go through when they're facing their own death, when they're facing their own demise. And then later, I think her original book was on like called On Grief and Dying or something like that. And then she later expanded the theory to encompass all sorts of traumatic events in people's lives. So death of a loved one as opposed to just your own death. Or she talks about ending of a relationship, divorce, addiction, incarceration, disease, just these major traumatic events that impact us. We'll oftentimes have to go through this model in order to, Jenny, does this sort of, to level set, what sort of folks do you normally deal with in your practice?
A lot of depression, anxiety, trauma, addictions, relationships.
Divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, religious transition.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the idea is to help people through this quicker because some people get stuck in stages. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, as you say, do people have to go through it? I don't know. I figure, you know, the key is to be aware of what's happening for us and really be honest about that. And so when someone comes in and they're speaking bargaining kind of statements, then it's a cue to me to say, what's really going on here? What are you grieving right now? And often they're like, well, I'm not grieving anything.
Well, could we maybe define those for people? Like, what do these actual five steps mean? So, like, what does bargaining look like? If I'm bargaining, how do I know that I'm bargaining?
Yeah, let's go there. But I think before we do, I want to underline the word grief. And, I'll use from my own experience. So when I went to therapy after my divorce, it was extremely helpful. And one thing that my therapist helped me realize was that what I was dealing with was grief over the end of this dream. Because, you know, like in the case of divorce or religion or a lot of these things, you invest a lot of energy into defining out your future. I'm going to go to the celestial kingdom and I'm going to sire 7 billion babies. Or I'm going to, you know...
Yeah, I'm really sad about missing out on that. That really sucks.
Or I'm going to... Motherhood is a delight. Or I'm going to go and we're going to go to France when we retire. Or all these things that over your lifetime, you set these dreams. And oftentimes, it's not the reality of the situation that's hard. It's this... All this emotion and thought that's built up over years that you have around these things. And I think that's part of this process of dealing with those things.
And it's not like you just go through it once, but usually there's so many little things that you aren't really even realizing are losses until all of a sudden you realize you're angry about something or you're depressed about something. And so there's within the bigger traumas, there are these losses day to day of what we thought life was going to look like and it doesn't look like.
And yeah, for sure. So the model, and I remember reading from the book that, you know, she argues that this is kind of a standard average progression, but like you say, people move back and forth. They'll cyclically go through it. And, you know, some, and your peaks and valleys will level out over time if you're progressing. And some people can encounter multiple stages at the same time. But this does tend to describe these sort of behaviors. And these are behaviors of grief, that you're moving beyond something, and there's something that's sad about that.
And can I just say that I feel like for different people, it's going to play out differently. So I know people that left the church really fast, and they processed it really fast. And I am still one of those people that hangs on, and I still grieve like every single day about it. And part of my work in therapy was like accepting that, because I'm like, I should be over
accepting
this by
denial?
Now. No, just accepting my grief. Like, that's not funny. But I mean, really, like, my thing is, I think some people feel guilty about feeling sad about it still. And I don't know, you know, I'm young, I'm new to this process, but it feels like right now, it feels like I'm never going to get over this.
Yeah. I think that's a common symptom of sort of depression. You feel like you're never going to get out of it. You're not ever going to escape this. You're going to feel like this all the time. And that's what the prison and the trap of that sort of place is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially when you're still, I mean, often I'll tell people it's hard to grieve when you're still experiencing the impact. So, for example, if you were to be in a war or have your city bombed, it's hard to grieve when people are still showing up with guns because you're still just trying to deal with the trauma that's currently happening. So, you know, to be in Utah, to have it all around you, as far as family and friends who are believing members, it's like you're still getting hits on a consistent basis. So it's tricky to go through the grieving process and really feel cleared.
So let's...
That means I'm never getting over it. Good.
Wow. It'll happen. Didn't we just say you feel like you'll never get out of it? So let's walk through these stages in relationship to those who leave the church. And these things can manifest themselves in different ways, because the first stage is denial. And oftentimes, remember, we're talking about denial of the grief, denial of the sadness, denial of the reality of the situation and what has to go through. And I think you see that we've talked about the ex-Mormon adolescence and some of this acting out. And I think some of that is natural boundary setting and natural exploration, but some of it is this drowning out the noise. They don't want to deal with the fact that what just happened. And let's be clear, leaving the church is very traumatic. And it depends on who you are, but it will impact almost every relationship you have. You can lose your job. You can lose your friends. You can lose your marriage. You can lose status in the community. There's just tons of loss.
Well, not just external stuff. Like the biggest shift for me, I mean, obviously that stuff is hard too, but my worldview changing was so difficult, and it's still difficult because it was really awesome for me to know all the answers. Like at 10 years old, I knew a lot more than I knew now, which sounds absurd, but to lose that is really hard.
So the denial aspect of when faced with that loss is just to pretend it's not there. And you'll hear a lot of ex-Mormons talk about how wonderful everything is now, how everything just got better, and everything's just peachy, and life just tastes better.
Wait, can I ask Jenny a question about that? Mm-hmm. So I hear that all the time too. And when I hear that, when I hear people say, oh yeah, I'm so much happier now, which I do know plenty of people who are legitimately happy after they've processed this. But people that say that, it often feels to me like they're trying to really fight against this paradigm of like, once you leave the church, you're going to be really unhappy. And you know, that's the narrative that my family and friends are saying about me now, like, oh, it's just so sad. And, you know, the reason why Lindsay does these podcasts is because she's unhappy and she's looking for happiness. And so I understand the, like, urge to say, whatever, I'm happy. I've never been happier. So is that part of denial, trying to fight that stereotype?
Yeah, I think partly it's taking a stance when someone said you couldn't be happy. And then I think, like, for me, you're also working with feeling grief and the sadness, and you're experiencing this sort of freedom. and feeling new feelings you've never felt before. And so I think a lot of people, I don't know, it's like, I'm happier than I've ever been. And sometimes I want to die, which has never happened to me. So I felt, I mean, I really felt bold.
Welcome to my mornings.
I've seen this same thing play out when a caregiver, usually an intense caregiver, loses a loved one. They have a mixed feeling of this overwhelming sense of relief that mom is gone, followed by an immediate sense of shame that they'd ever think such a thing. And because there was this huge burden that they had. And even if you're not a caregiver, to watch a loved one die or suffer is a huge emotional burden. And there's a sense of relief at the same time. And so you'll hear denial-y statements. Oh, my mom is still with me. Even people get into sort of, I don't want to call it psychosis, but they'll, oh, I hear her talk to me at night and stuff like that, where they try to pretend that things aren't the way they are. They try to pretend there's not a reality of the situation. Denial. Second phase is anger. And this is what really marks a lot of ex-Mormons, or at least the way they're stereotypically played out. Because and I think what's key here is this Kubler-Ross model shows us that this is a normal psychological pattern. That being an angry ex-Mormon is not, it doesn't mean you're crazy or you're nuts. It means that you're going through this normal grieving cycle from where you were. And one of it is it's that feeling, this is not fair. You know, why do I have to do this? How can this be? And you'll point out, why do they put up that goddamn resigned curtain? I want to watch them make a martini. You know, you're just mad at everything.
And anger is interesting because it's such a fiery emotion. Really, when you feel anger, watch your body. You'll feel heat. You'll usually feel more agitation. So there's like a movement to it. And I think anger is really a part of making changes. It's what helps us to start to make changes.
And in Mormonism, anger is interesting because you're not supposed to be angry. So you've been taught your whole life, especially as women, you know, we can't express that. So, you know, it gets filtered out through all these wonky ways like passive aggression. We're really good at that. And behind anger is fear and shame, right? And there's a lot to be afraid of when you start questioning your faith or when you feel betrayed by the church. We've been taught our whole life to be afraid of that, right? And we're taught all these consequences, like if you stop believing, A, B, C, and D will happen to you. And once you know that's not true in your head, still part of you kind of retains that memory. And at least for myself, my anger component has felt a lot of fear, I guess, behind it.
Yeah, I think that'd be natural. That anger always, it's to me, it's always sourced in something. It doesn't just rise out of nothing. There's something that you're scared about, or that's emotionally distressing, or something else that's causing that rise in anger.
In a way, you still feel impacted, also, or bound by the traumatic thing, and so. I'm thinking about this not so much in relation to death. All of a sudden, I'm wondering, how does that specifically work with death? But, you know, in the church, often part of the reason why anger can last so long is because you still feel bound by certain rules. So when you talk about people being angry at the Iron Curtain, it's the sense of, I don't want to be bound by rules anymore. I don't want to be bound by things that I've been bound by, but still feeling like you're this victim of being stuck. You know,
yeah, it's interesting you use the word victim, because a victim mindset comes up quite a bit. That I've heard people, you know, who go to a party for the first time after they've been out of the church, and they get really ripped and drunk, and then they throw up and they wake up, you know, with spaghetti in their hair or whatever. And, you know, and they'll still blame the church. Oh, it's the church. They didn't teach me boundaries, right? They told me they didn't teach me how to drink, you know, and it just comes out everywhere. And luckily, people move through that phase.
Well, and I think there's something to be explored there. I don't think that you should feel shame for feeling that way, because I don't think that the church equips you for a lot of these real life scenarios, and that you can feel angry about that. That's okay. You have to process that and work through it. My thing was, when I went to therapy, I was given, I don't know if there's a name for it, but there's the victim, the survivor, and the thriver mode. And I had not gone into the thriver mode. I was stuck in the victim mode, and sometimes I would go into the survivor mode. Like, okay, I'm not a victim anymore. I'm surviving this. I'm doing okay. And then something would hurt, and I'd be like, oh, gosh, the church really wronged me. I'm so screwed. Oh, my gosh. But the goal is to get to the thriving stage, right? Yes?
Yeah.
Look at me like a
therapist. But first we have to go through the bargaining phase, which is next. And remember when Kubler-Ross set this model, it was really about people who were facing down their own death. And this is where we start getting into a lot of supernatural thinking oftentimes. But even people who are not inherently supernatural do this sort of bargaining. They do bargaining with themselves. I find myself doing it from time to time, you know. Oh, I'm not going to eat that much cheese right before bed anymore. And I'm going to do, you know, whatever you start doing these things in your head where you say, if I do this, then I'm going to get through this situation. Just please, just let me hold on for this one more time. And then I swear I won't do that thing anymore. You know, this is how you get through a long race, mm-hmm. by the way. If you're a marathon runner, you're going to be doing bargaining at mile 17. There's no way around that. It's just a normal part of that reaction. I think one of the powers of religion, you know, as I was reading through this model, is religion codifies this and walks you through it. Mm-hmm. Religion has you bargain with by as a matter of practice. So it takes normal psychological practice and then it codifies it. It's really fascinating to think about that religion has you walk through these phases. Of you could map these on to the pattern of repentance very clearly, and that religion oftentimes I think is so powerful because it has evolved to mirror our psychological patterns. Because Kubler-Ross didn't invent this; she discovered it because this happens to play out in a way that our psychology reacts to things around us. I think.
So I have another question for you. The term bargaining sounds still kind of nebulous to me. Can you give me like examples of how someone recovering from Mormonism would bargain?
Yeah, so bargaining is a little tricky, but okay. So bargaining would be something like, if I can only act happy, my family will see that the church is not true. You know, I've left the church. If my family can see that I'm happy, then they will accept my choice. So it's any kind of if-then correlation statement, causation statement that may or may not be at all true. But
I think it's marked, to build on what you're saying, I think it's marked by trying to control the reaction or thoughts of others
yes.
by your own actions. If I do this, then they, you know. And I think a lot of people get stuck in the bargaining phase or frankly those nom sort of people. The people who keep going to church and going to mm-hmm. church. And if I only just show an appearance, then I'll keep my family happy and I'll be able to stay with my kids. My marriage won't end.
Yeah.
And it's that if I... Because if you think about it, these things are abstractly connected. If I fill out this, if I keep this position in the bishopric, then my wife won't leave me, right? That's classic bargaining because those two things aren't intrinsically connected.
So what's the function of bargaining though? Like,
so it's a way to not, and all of these can be ways to try to hold on and keep the loss from happening, keep the loss from being real. So even in, you know, I mean, even backing up for just one second to denial, we talked about one aspect of denial. There's something going on over here.
Lindsay just gave me the bird.
I did not.
She flipped me off. You were talking about
I would not do that during such a serious podcast.
And she's looking at porn and giving me the bird over here.
I'm not
I want you to take
porn.
This seriously, Lindsay. This is not a game. Good Lord.
So I'm continuing. So... So in denial, one of the other things with denial that we didn't talk about is just pretending it's not happening. So people who truly don't want to be there anymore or no longer are believing and just close their eyes to that completely. Or when I first left, it was like, I'm just taking a step back. I don't know what this means about my future. And I knew deep down that I wasn't going to be back. And so bargaining, when you get to bargaining, I don't know how I was connecting that in my head, but I was thinking it's really similar to what you see happen with abuse victims where they just deny that it's happening. But once they move out of that, then the purpose of bargaining becomes to try to somehow keep that loss from being real. So you come out of bargaining, you see, oh, this is a reality for me that I'm being harmed in some way. Something I thought was a certain way is not what it was. And bargaining is a way to try to fix that or change that. So if I can just fix the church, then I can stay. If, you know. And when you watch people do this in abuse families, it's often, yeah, trying to change the other person's, the abuser's way of thinking or reacting. If I'm nice enough, he won't hurt me when he comes home tonight. You know?
And sometimes it works, right? Totally works, right?
Yeah. Well, and
like you can bargain, like you can change the church and it will work, right?
And bargaining is tricky because some days it will work, right? So the drunk spouse comes home and the other one thinks if I'm nice, if I cook, everything will be okay. And some nights that's true. So the pattern is...
You got a woman to pray in general conference. Does
right.
Does that count?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I see where we're going.
So since yeah. Lindsay's dealing with her bargaining, we need to warn her that her next phase is depression.
Oh, no.
Mormon Expression is a listener-funded program. If you like what you hear, please visit us at mormonexpression.com and consider becoming a subscribing member. While you're there, let us know what you think about the show.
You know, the last phase is acceptance. To me, it seems that depression and acceptance are sort of interrelated. They're both a matter of accepting, coming to terms with the reality of the situation. You get hit by the depression, which is sort of the overwhelming sadness of it. And to talk about in terms of philosophers oftentimes talk about the void. And I think I've heard people who are processing out of faith talk about coming up to a loss of belief in God and using that very word, the void, this idea that things are meaningless, this whole process, all the energy I put into this is without meaning, without purpose. And I think that's at the core of depression, this helplessness that people feel, unable to control their emotion or their state of being.
And I was going to say, you know, even the word depression, often people will try to describe it as this depressed feelings, meaning you can't feel your feelings. You feel sort of numb. And so it's, yeah, it feels like a void. It feels like a nothingness.
I just want to say with the paradigm that you just set up right there, John, that you said when you leave the church and you have to confront what every human being has to confront, which is why are we here? When you say, well, now I've got nothing. I had God and now I have nothing. That, I think, is a product of our teaching because what are we taught our whole lives? Isn't it sad that other people don't have, you know, the truth, that families can't be forever? So we kind of still adopt that Mormon way of thinking, like, yep, since I don't believe in God, I guess my family's not forever anymore. You know, that kind of thing. It's just a very Mormon way of dealing with... No? You disagree?
No. I think that you're saying something that's very fascinating because I think depression has to do with this kind of false understanding of the state of affairs. You think things are without meaning, you think things are hopeless, but they're really not. And what I'm cognitive of when you're saying that is how the church and religion manipulates that state. What they're basically doing from what you're talking about is they create depression in people. They know that if it's a situation of hopelessness that you feel you can't get out of it, they're going to tell you you're going to be hopeless. They're going to put walls up that make it feel hopeless. And that's why acceptance is breaking through that and accepting the reality. So if you're depressed because you're overweight, you might think, oh, well, no one will love me. I can't do anything. I just will just eat some more or just stay in. But then there's the wake up and say, so I'm fat, God damn it, I'm going to go out and do things anyway. And then you just go do things anyway, and then you break through and you accept the condition, right? And you find out that a lot of that construction that made you feel sad or unlovable or unaccepted was all false. It was all a false dichotomy. And acceptance really is acknowledging the situation. Hey, I am fat, but I can still wear biker shorts.
Well, can we talk about me some more?
Yes.
So I'm perpetually in a sad state over the church. It's been something that I've been very public about. People have had to listen to it, and I'm sorry, it's not done, so it'll probably be another couple of years. I have no idea. But recently, I was just telling Jenny before this, I went to Ordain Women, and it was a really painful, painful experience for me because I had to go feel with my body. It's sounding strange. I had to go feel with my body what I've always known.
That's because you were fighting with the bouncers.
Yeah, I know. We're so rough and disrespectful, so they say. When we talk about acceptance, it was really hard for me because with bargaining, you know, I had to actually confront physical sexism. I had to go see my people, my Mormon people, shut the gates on me and turn me away. And I knew that I had to do it. It was something that I knew was a very personal thing that I had to go do, but it's kind of rocked my world. I mean, I knew the turnout. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I knew they weren't going to let me in, but feeling it with my body was something that I can't describe. And I haven't been the same since. It's been a few weeks, and I think I have been depressed about it. But this is so dumb. I was listening to Hey Jude, which is a great song to listen to when you're down. And he says, you know, the moment you let her into your heart, then you can start to make it better. And I was like, that's what I got to do. I have to accept. I always took that as love. Like, well, I have to love the church and then I'll forgive them for being betrayed. And I don't think that's what it means for me. I think for me, letting it into my heart means accepting that the church has harmed me.
Yeah.
And that's letting it sit with me.
Yeah. And hard. I mean, that's a big moment of, even though you've been going through this grieving process with lots of different things since you left, as you were talking about that and being able to feel it with your body. I mean, that's a coming out of denial at a heightened phase. You know what I mean? So even though you've been coming out of denial all along, to feel it with your body, that is a moment of stepping out of denial.
Well, and you described depression as sort of a numbness. So it'll be a re-engagement. Mm-hmm. Of your feelings. And for me, you know, when I went through this stage after my divorce, that was really important as me to realize that I was sad and I suddenly felt sad and then I started feeling better. But I was pushing off on that for so long. And when I accepted that it was sad, it was a sad situation, then I was able to work through it.
I know that for me with acceptance, like I had a trauma happen, right? This one time. Anyway. I realized that I had reached that point of acceptance, at least with that particular trauma, when I realized that, yeah, that traumatic thing happened to me, but at the same time, I went to Disneyland once too, and that was a thing that happened to me. And these two things both happened to me, and they're both part of who I am now. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to talk to you about going to Disneyland. I mean, that was a great time, but the traumatic thing that happened to me is part of me too. And that's kind of how I realized that I had accepted it, was when I thought about it the same way as I thought about that trip to Disneyland.
Yeah. So you can feel the good again. You can feel all parts of your life, not just what you've lost.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. We've been talking about this model in relationship to ex-Mormons, which actually I think is not that interesting.
That's because you're a heartless, black-hearted monster.
And that's not the reason that I decided to do this topic. But I wanted you all to listen, because I don't think Kubler-Ross is important, really, to understand ex-Mormons. Kubler-Ross is important to understand your friends and family when you leave the church. Because remember that Kubler-Ross set up this model to talk about somebody faced with death, with their own death. And if you can understand this, and we're going to walk through it again, from the point of view of those who are around you when you leave the faith, I think it'll help you better understand what's going on there. Because we've talked about on this podcast, and everybody's left the church, talks about the mistakes they make. And one of the biggest mistakes that is made on both sides is we lack empathy for one another. And as we walk through these stages, I want you to think about those who are around you, and they do some really, really douchey things. Let's be clear. And very hurtful things to people. And shunning and throwing people out of communities. And there's just terrible things. But those things come from a place. They don't come from the fact that these are bad people. There's a reason they go through it. And this has been said before in many ways, if not, well, in a lot of ways, leaving the church, falling into apostasy, is worse than dying. And they have to process it in a way that sometimes keeps them from completing the cycle and really grieving. There are people who do it. They're able to, once you leave the church, they're able to grieve you and then reestablish a relationship with you. But oftentimes that relationship is still a shadow of what it once was.
Well, when you say grieving, I would want to grieve you. I want to go in even further. It's not just that they're losing you. I mean, they feel like they are losing you in a very spiritual, eternal sense. They're losing you. What they're also grieving, though, is their dreams for you. You have to give them time to let their dreams for you die. And I think that this happens a lot for all parents as their kids grow up and they, you know, disappoint you or you do stuff that they didn't expect. But I think that that is what I see with my loved ones. They had dreams for me that I am not fulfilling. And they've put a lot of stock and energy and time into those. And I've killed them. So
well, think about this from the point of view of somebody who's married and their spouse leaves the church. And everything that they've been working for, everything they've invested in for here to all, what's basically the meaning and purpose of their existence, you have inadvertently just taken from them in a way that is emotionally violent. And people talk about how, like if an ex-Mormon drinks coffee or something, how the reaction seems overwrought because it's just coffee. But it's this front and visceral reminder that they will not have the person they love through all eternity, and that's what the whole purpose of life is. You just shot their entire purpose of life to hell. And we talk over and over again about families are forever. And this is the message that's given that they stencil on their fucking walls. Go into Utah, and they all have these taupe walls with this. Is there like a stencil?
You've been to dinner at my house, haven't you?
Is there a stencil section of Deseret Book? Where do they get these things?
Vinyl. You can get them everywhere. And like, I have a neighbor that makes them.
There'll be a big picture on their wall, and it'll say families are forever or something like that above them. And you fucked that up. You took away their dream.
Do you see the one that says, a journey to forever?
No.
I can go on. There's like a ton of these. Like, it all started with, what's, all because two people fell in love.
Oh, yeah. My parents have that one on their wall. Randy?
So, actually, saying with what you mean, where they get all worked up over you want to have a cup of coffee or something, that's actually one of the things that I found really interesting after I had left the church. I hit a point where I'd been gone for 2 years or so. I think it was the first major family thing I got invited on, where we went up to some timeshare hotel thing that my sister owned. And my mom comes to me like the first morning we're there after we stayed overnight, and she says, so there's a coffee maker in the room, but we'd prefer if you didn't use it, but they have complimentary coffee in the lobby, right? And while that kind of... it sounds a little weird, but I think that shows like an acceptance of, you know, I don't even know. She didn't know if I drank coffee, because quite frankly, didn't, because I didn't like it at the time. But she wanted to extend that. And it was a really odd olive branch. So I think that it's the little things are how people express things, or what they attach the bigger dreams to.
And when we get to acceptance, I think we need to talk. Those are great things, and they do work through the process. So let's go through the process in terms of loved ones who have somebody close to them leave the church. Denial. You'll get hit right away with scriptures. You'll get hit right away with people telling you need to pray more. All this kind of stuff.
Or this, you've always believed. I know that you have a testimony. Right. I know that you do.
And they say some perverse things like, you really don't believe what you're saying. This is just a game. You were always my rebellious child. because it's a denial of the reality of the situation. They don't want to accept that you've really lost the faith. And they will externalize it into, you know,
you've been offended.
You have a bad spouse. You got bad mushrooms. I don't know. Whatever they want to deny the reality of the situation.
What's that?
You
want to
go and sin. Sorry.
Yeah, you want to sin. But I mean, that's a denial of the front.
I want to go and sin. True.
Well, it's a denial. To say that somebody wants to sin or they were offended is to deny that they came to a conclusion on their own, right? It's to externalize this whole thing and saying it's not real. You just look at too much monkey porn or whatever it is people look at.
And monkey porn will get you every time. Let that be a lesson, monkey porn viewers. Stop Googling it right now.
What you have to Google is sloth porn. This is a real thing.
Oh, you know what? I see what you did there. Preying on the vulnerable.
Whatever
what
you do,
doing.
Do not send Lindsay pictures of sloths. She does not.
Oh my gosh, don't put it out there. Phobias are a real thing, people.
They are. There's no point in denying them.
Some epigenetic scarring happened with sloths.
Sometimes
in my youth.
You go into the second phase, which is anger. So you'll see this. You'll see people flare up on Facebook or wherever else. So the first thing will be this denial. They don't want to deal with the reality of the situation. They don't want to. And they'll sometimes go long ways. There's families that have years of not having a conversation or acknowledging that, the reality was it. There were a few years I was sort of inactive before I ever came out to my family, and we would always talk about church. That was the number one thing my family talked about. But then they stopped asking me what my calling was, and for years they didn't. This was a long extended denial that they didn't want to ask me if I went to church or not, but they wouldn't even talk to me about the same sort of things. I've used my dad's quote before, but I think it's hilarious, but I'm sorry, Dad. We were talking years later about how because we would all complain about the church. That's one of the things we would do. And then he said, well, I stopped complaining to the church around you because I realized you were serious about it. So, but actually, I had acceptance by that time. You know, for me, it didn't have any edge. Okay, so anger. You'll see people lash out. And they'll lash out hard sometimes. And there are people who experience this in very unfortunate ways. People, they will announce to you that you're being written out of the will. They will not invite you to the family reunion. They will
stage an intervention.
They will stage interventions, but they'll get pretty heated up in their rhetoric. But they're facing down. Remember, because you're thinking, why did my family turn to such dicks? They're trying to deal with this loss. That's the point. They're going through an anger in relationship to the loss of you, to the love that they have for you and for that relationship you had with them before.
Yeah, my husband and I were just talking about kind of the experiences we've been having and how this has been the most traumatic experience of our entire life. And the people that we needed the most around us are the ones who have kind of shunned us. And they feel betrayed and we feel betrayed. And you know, when someone dies, you can be angry at the dead person, but they don't have to sit there and take the beating. And so that's what makes it really difficult, is because both sides are really hurting with this.
John, I'm just listening to you talk about the fear of the family members, and I've just been so super shocked at what a strong reaction it is. And I thought, okay, they are scared they're losing me, but they are also super scared that they might lose their faith too, because mm-hmm. I was this person who was so believing, and if I can challenge it, maybe there's some basis, whether it's conscious or subconscious, that the world is scarier and not as tight. And I have found with my family members that there is just this real fear of engagement. They'll engage me to a degree. And then when they start to feel it, when they start to feel the pull of like maybe ideology that makes sense to them, that contradicts Mormonism, it's super scary to them. So I think that that's part of it, whether they realize it or not. At least I think that's common.
Well, and Joanna Brooks just spoke at our Sunstone had a Navigating the Borderlands conference, and she spoke on the shame of being Mormons, how Mormons have always had to deal with shame. Mm. We feel shame because we're Mormons, blah, 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 blah. And she said that she noticed a long time, you know, when you leave the church, at least for me, I felt apologetic. I was always, I'm so sorry I left the church family. I'm so sorry that I believe this way. I'm so sorry. And that shifts. But she said after a while, there's this paradigm shift where your family starts, instead of you looking at them, wondering if they're going to judge you, they look at you saying, are you judging me because I'm Mormon? Do you think I'm a bigot? Do you think I'm the one that's weird? And I think that's interesting because I think that does happen eventually.
Absolutely. Yeah, so just remember the anger, which is one of the hardest things to deal with when you're on the receiving end of this, is coming from this processing as opposed to just everybody suddenly turning into a dick. All right, bargaining. This really plays out explicitly in the temple rolls and all these other things. I mean, they will start bargaining. There'll be fasts for you, and they will pray for you, and they will construct all sorts of ways to sort of make it right. On the downside, some families will unfortunately construct booby traps for you. I had a friend this wasn't me. I had a friend whose mother wouldn't ever really help her. So she would give assistance to other of her children. But this woman, years later, she'd processed this, acknowledged this, that she did not want to give any means for somebody to stay out of the church, right? Mm. So in essence, this trap was set up where the normal love and interaction assistance that a family would give, because you are out of the church, they're not going to give that assistance. Mm. And it is a form of bargaining. Because if they can only hit rock bottom, if they can only, then they will turn to sweet baby Jesus, and then they will find the loving grace in their hearts. And this sort of stuff happens all the time. And there's a sort of bargaining, there's a sort of weird bargaining that Mormons do, which is, if the world can only see how great we are, then they'll all want to become Mormons. And so I'm going to live my peachy life around my apostate boy the best I can. And if he sees how well I can peaches, well, by gum, he's coming back.
By gum, I hope so. And it works. I mean, when you watch people peach, I...
is peach a verb?
It is now, after seeing you do your little peach dance over there in the corner. I was teaching like John Larson.
I was in Texas for a business trip in July, and I was by myself, and I stopped by a little barbecue joint one night for dinner, and I was sitting at a table, and I was watching this little family. There was a mom and dad and I think four children, and they were just, you know, so cute, and they looked like they were really happy, and the dad looked like he was really involved with the kids, and the mom had like this white t-shirt on underneath her shirt, and I saw her and I noticed the t-shirt and I thought, well, of course, she's Mormon. I mean, to have a family like that, you have to be Mormon.
Right.
And I just had this fear come up that I can't have a happy or stable home or relationship if I'm not Mormon, you know, and this is after having been out for a while. So it's just funny how those bargaining things can get you, even when someone's not attempting to manipulate you. It's like all those messages I've had from church and family, all of a sudden they come through this woman, and you know, the bargaining is there often.
Absolutely. And I had a friend who had a family member that would, she was really good at constructing consequences like you talked about. Like, you know, they say, if you leave the church, you're going to be unhappy. Well, she wasn't unhappy, so we had to make sure she wasn't happy and feeling it. And her therapist said something interesting, which I think is really interesting. When someone does that, when someone orchestrates these big plots or to manipulate, manipulation is about not having your own needs met. So the person that is manipulating or constructing these consequences, it's all based in sheer, in shame and fear and a loss of power. Because you have no control. You have no control when you've raised your kids in primer. You were promised. You read your scriptures every day as a family, and your kids won't go astray, and then they do. That's really hard.
It's a tough... And because, you know, like we've talked about in the last few podcasts, so much of your time and energy is taken up in this church process, that the failure of having a child who goes astray is the biggest failure. What's the McKay quote they have all the time? No success can compensate for failure in the home. And no failure can blot out everything else like failure in the home, right? So if you reverse the quote, everything this person has done in their life is suddenly without meaning. They've lost. They lost life. And that's a tough pill to swallow.
Mm-hmm. P.S. The woman in Texas wasn't Mormon. She took her shirt off. She had a tank top on.
Oh.
Just one. You cannot be Mormon and have a stable life.
Depression. And unfortunately, the negative thing about the Kubler-Ross is people can get stuck in these cycles. And this can dominate people for a long time about this and color relationships for 20, 30, 40 years. And because of this failure... That can dominate. And I think oftentimes people will, the ex-Mormons, the people who leave the church, need to realize that the fight is coming, and that's in the early stages, but there's going to be this sadness in these people's lives that they have to process through this thing. And sometimes what's unfortunate, well, it may be fortunate, is if an ex-Mormon's kind of going through this cycle, they're never going to completely line up. And like the ex-Mormon is probably likely to be a few stages ahead. So when the ex-Mormon is in depression, their family might be in anger, which is just going to compound everything. And so these cycles are not necessarily going to line up, and they might synergize in a really negative pattern. But recognizing that depression in people around you, I think it's hard because you can't manage their feelings. Mm-hmm. But you can try to be a lot more sensitive about things.
Well, and what Jenny was saying, when it's hard to grieve when the trauma is still coming at you, remember oftentimes these family members are still going to church and they're still hearing about how you are destroying their family or about how you're losing out on eternal blessings or about how they are as well. And so that's a really hard thing to combat. It's not like they're going to go through depression and then like someday be over it. If they're going to church, they're going to hear this a lot.
And every time you come sashaying into their house with your bare naked shoulders, rubbing it in their face, they're going to have to process through it again.
So about a year after I left, about a year after I told my parents, and they didn't say much. Well, we had a conversation when we first initially talked about it, and then we didn't talk about it again for about a year. Nothing was said. And one day I was talking with my dad and he was saying really, really genuinely, I've had friends who have had children die and I always thought about how painful that would be. And he said, and now I know what that must feel like for them. And I didn't pick up that he was trying to manipulate me with it. I think he was genuinely trying to express what it had been like for him, but I did feel angry. It did trigger my anger, but it was also really relieving because all of a sudden I had this feeling of, oh, okay, yeah, no wonder this last year has felt so offish. You've been feeling for a year like I have died. And, you know, so this is really real for people, even if they aren't expressing it to you. And it can make things feel really offish because often people don't want to talk about their part in the grieving process because it can trigger and conflict with where you are in your process. So it's like this whole tangle of like everyone grieving different things, you know, it's really tricky.
Absolutely. And I was going to make an inappropriate a metaphor about adultery and death, but I'm going to leave it on the table.
Acceptance. No Nazis. You have nothing up your Nazi sleeve.
But the night's young. Acceptance. This is the most important phase, and a lot of people talk about this, and it sometimes takes years and years to get to this phase where they can reengage the relationship on a level that accepts you for who you are. I think because the active Mormons aren't really listening to this podcast, what our role as those who leave is to extend the hand of acceptance out. And that means accepting them. I think we've hinted at this, but it's easy for us ex-Mormons to be on our high horse constantly about how superior our position is and how ludicrous the church is. And you record podcasts and you put them out and you make fun of it over and over and over and over again and you never stop. But there's this relationship that has to be on this mutual acceptance, one with another, that is also going to drive that acceptance of themselves. And I've been reading a lot about relationships, and you know, in terms of having a good relationship, oftentimes there's a certain amount of interplay of vulnerability that has to be there. That hey, I'm not perfect. I could have made mistakes, and I'm outside this religion, and I might do things that are not perfect. And it's hard, and that's a hard thing to admit, given their paradigm, which is if you do all this stuff, then you're going to be perfect, you're not having problems. On the same thing, it's hard for them to admit and face down saying, well, you could be happy and you could be living the best life for you. And maybe everything that I believe is not perfect for everybody, and maybe you're not exactly wrong. Those are two hard positions to bridge. And I'm not saying that we can bridge them, but we can say, I love you, that I'm still here. I'm still your son. I'm still your mother. I'm still your father. And that relationship's not changed. And I think we are the ones who left the church, we're the ones who sort of broke the peace. Now, there's good reason for that, but we're the ones who caused the mess. And I think sometimes we have to take the lead in cleaning it up and reestablishing those relationships on the level that they can be on, sort of ignoring this other stuff.
Well, and the phrase that just popped through my head is, and it's worth it. And maybe it's not worth it for everyone, but it was so worth it for me, even though my family was grieving and even though I was grieving. On some level, there's crickets. On some level, all of a sudden I was able to be more myself than I've been able to be with my family and in my life. So, and that, again, may not be true for everyone, but I don't know. Going through the grieving process is really painful, but it is powerful because you come out the other side and you know more about reality. You know more about humanity, and hopefully it gives you some good lessons.
Yeah. I did the talk with my parents thing, and the tears and sadness and begging me not to be an alcoholic. But now it's entered this kind of quiet zone where we just, they don't ignore me, but it's obviously we're not talking about it. How do you approach that? Do you go and have your own intervention? I mean, do you go up to them and say, hey, I'd like to, I feel like we need to revisit this. We should be talking about this again. Is that something to do?
I think it depends on what you're experiencing. So if you genuinely feel curious, you could approach it really vulnerably that way and just let them know, I'm kind of curious how you're doing since we talked a year ago or 2 years ago. How have things been for you?
Okay, I'll do it.
Report back.
One thing that was healthy for me or helped me, I don't know if it made a difference, but I told my parents, my siblings, saying, you can ask me whatever you want, but you may not want to hear my answer, so I'm not going to volunteer it. But feel free. If you want to ask me about my faith or my religion or whatever, I'm happy. But I'll answer the question. And they've generally chosen not to ask me. So go ahead.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of a story in my family. My dad's kind of been a closet non-believer for most of my life. And I remember one time he said to me after I was kind of leaving, we talked about it more, and he said, I always wondered why my family members didn't approach me and ask me questions, and because he never really made that invitation, he never really talked about it, and so I think the whole family was left in this awkward position of no one ever talks about it at all, mm-hmm. because he didn't bring it up and no one else felt comfortable with it or whatever, but yeah, just no. He was sad that no one approached him.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember feeling like that even after I had discussions with my family, like, why aren't they checking in and finding out where I'm at with it now? But I think, if that's what we're feeling, then that's a good thing just to be vulnerable and say, I'm feeling curious how you're doing. And I'm feeling like I want to share, but I don't know if you really want to hear. So, it's checking in and seeing sometimes. And it's so scary to do that, So if you go into a conversation like that and you're a little shaky and it's scary, that's really normal.
So the last thought I have is when you leave the church or move on in your faith, you're going to come to a better place for you. You will. You'll process through it. You'll find your own genuine life. For some people, that means going back to the church. For most people, it means going on to something else. And you will find peace with that and build yourself a new life. And you, in a way, can recover. And because that they still go to church, they can't. They always are going to be reminded of that empty seat, right? So my plea is for more empathy towards them, because you're going to get your reward. You're going to have a better life, and you're going to have a more true and authentic life, and you might go through some adolescence, you might make some mistakes, but you'll find your moral compass, and you'll find what works for you and what feels comfortable, and you'll find people in your life that you can surround yourself with that resonate with you. But they're stuck back there, and they have to try to go through this process. So, and I don't know the cure. We talk about this stuff. I just made it sound like I have this great relationship with my family. I love them, but I remember the last Christmas party. Now they're all married and in the church, and I'm divorced and I am what I am. And we just kind of sit there and stare at each other without much to say. And I don't know what to say to them. If anybody can tell me, because I don't want to make them feel uncomfortable and they don't want to make me feel uncomfortable. And, I don't watch sports, and so we don't have anything to talk about. We have nothing, literally nothing to talk about. So I don't have all the answers, but I do know that if we can all try to find to be more empathetic, because they have the harder position. It's tougher to be the one who was left behind in this god-awful church than it is to be the one who left. Do you say that in therapy?
Yes.
Oh, these issues are tough. And I think the more that all of us can develop empathy for each other.
And ourselves. I mean, the whole mantra is be gentle with yourself. I mean, be gentle with yourself and your family members. Even forgive them, for they know not what they do.
I wanted to share a positive example of acceptance from my mom this weekend, because it just really meant a lot to me. She, while we were in the kitchen, asked me, can we talk about how I'm going to talk to your kids about religion? And, I mean, first that she asked really meant a lot. They know that a year ago I conveyed to them, you cannot say negative things about me and what I believe and what their parents believe. So they know that, but I really appreciated that she reached out to me and wanted to set those boundaries. And I am glad that I was far enough out of the angry, better stage to be able to see that and recognize the importance of allowing her own space to operate, because these things are really important and meaningful to her. And it was a short, simple conversation, but I think it was really healing for both of us to connect that way.
That's cool.
Excellent. We all need to find better ways to reach across the divide. And I think some of these things are changing. I think the church is softening its rhetoric a little bit on apostates. We're still going to hell and outer darkness, and we're going to lose our genitals, but we can get invited to the family reunions now, you know, at least for time, but not for all eternity.
Well, they can come down and visit us.
Oh, they can, yes. That'd be gracious of them. I'll look forward to those visits. All right. Well, thanks again to Jenny and to Lindsay for participating in our fabulous, beautiful audience tonight. You're all wonderful. Everybody's special. And as always, the discussion continues over on the website. You can go to our Facebook group and see what's going on. Thanks, everybody, and have a great night.
Mormon Expressions is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find more about our current initiatives. Mormon Expressions is recorded live in downtown Salt Lake on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. If you're in the area, please come join us in the studio.